Hi, Larry Kleinman. Welcome again to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill. Great to be here again.
Larry Kleinman co-founded, was a longtime secretary treasurer of Pecon, Oregon's farm worker union, headquartered in Woodburn, Oregon. He remains an advisor to Pecon, and he also works with the Fair Immigration Reform Movement. It's called FIRM. It's the National Lobby for Immigrant Rights. And it's the group that charts the national policy of the immigrant rights movement. So, Larry Kleinman, in reading your writing and policy papers and talking to you, I realize that you've developed for the immigrant rights movement what in the last election some of us on the left called a dump Trump, fight and force Biden strategy. That strategy has three major objectives: to stop Trump and Trumpism from gaining power. And Trump is definitely going to try and create some version of a white supremacist autocratic country, or even worse. The second objective for us, the strategy, is to gain as much as we can gain for the working people, including immigrants, gain it from a Democratic Party-led government, which we can expect and require to protect space for dissent and organizing and fair elections. And the third objective is to do this while staying independent of the Democratic Party, often supporting Democratic Party candidates, but also building our forces in politics and in the movements, the labor movement, the immigrants' rights movement, the environmental movement, and climate action movements, BIPOC struggles, feminist animal rights, struggles by small farmers, on and on and on. So that we're in position when the right time comes, perhaps some sort of climate and economic crisis. In that crisis, if we in fact build our forces, it's quite possible that we will be chosen by the people to take over and superintend the great societal mobilization that will be necessary to maintain a livable planet for humans. So, Larry, tell us how you've come to understand the present political world, the great threats we face, and why you support a version of the Stop Right, Fight and Force, and sometimes support the Democratic Party.
Well, few have been stigmatized, targeted, and put in fear more than immigrants during the Trump era. And I think it's created deep trauma, as well as for the broader country, and what we thought were our democratic institutions, some of which turned out just to be customs or norms. So we've all gotten a thorough political and even cultural stress test, and it's shaken things up deeply. Inside of that, immigrants have realized even the meager protections that immigrants had, how at risk they were. And so immigrants played an important role, and their families, in defeating Trump. It was a united front effort, and we carry that forward, that political effort, into what I call cleanup on every aisle, the repair, the restoration, and the transformation, or the rebuilding, which I think is going to take a decade. But in this moment now, what we face along with everybody else is moving through and ending the pandemic, reviving the economy, which means, in shorthand, reviving the consumer economy, but that will leave many behind. And so thirdly, it's shaping the quote-unquote better that Biden and others talk about, using this moment to put into motion transformational, not just restorative, but transformational changes that can be built on to really get at the root causes of so many of the inequities and the causes of suffering and exploitation in our country and in the world. Now, that has a very particular expression for immigrants, both executive, administrative, legislative, short-term, long-term. But that, I think, is the broader panorama of the moment and the context.
How to do that, though, Larry, in the face of, for one, a hostile Senate led by McConnell that wants to see the Democrats failing and is unlikely to cooperate in any of the things that might be necessary to revive the economy. And then there's also Trump, who almost won the election. He's built a huge base. It moves in white supremacist directions. It's very loyal to him. It now controls the Republican Party. And he, and maybe even if he leaves the scene or becomes a eminent Greece and they build monuments to him while he's still alive, but he's going to do everything he can to further build that base and stir up public distrust and anger. How is the Biden administration going to deal with that hostile Senate and still vicious Trump?
Well, you know, in addition to coming out of the pandemic, in addition to everything that is piled up here, all the wreckage, it's going to be deeply challenging to do that in the context of what you outlined, of what you described. But I would point out two things about it. One, we've been in this mode before, and so we have some lived experience about how to deal with entrenched opposition. And secondly, in the broader political realm that you described of Trump post-presidency. So I do completely agree with your assumption that Trump will be out there stirring up forces. He has no loyalty to party. His only loyalty is to himself and the folks he chooses to collude with him. So he'll attack Republicans, even if it undermines the party apparatus or the party power. And this will both, as you, I think, said, it'll freeze the Republican Party in place politically, but it'll also damage the Republican Party in key moments. For example, in the 2022 primaries, I don't have any doubt that he's going to descend on in key states where there are contested seats, Senate seats, and in key districts, and bash his opponents and uplift his followers, even if it costs the party their more politically viable nominee, because it is a raw expression of his power, which is what, in the end of the day, feeds his need for attention and accolade. And it's a profit motive for him. The only successful business he's ever run is media. And that's what he exactly, I think, is going to get into. Real estate's been a loser for him, as the New York Times analysis of his tax returns showed us all. So he's going to make his money in media and in political operation. So that is both a threat and an opportunity for progressive forces. And in the Senate, as far as legislative obstruction, I think that the posture for all of us is to make as clear as possible to as many people as possible that will listen to us what the cost is of obstruction, whether it's a big relief bill post-inauguration, or whether it's putting it in the context of the opposition, the unyielding opposition to the Affordable Care Act, which at first was the Tea Party's platform to springboard itself into the lead position of opposition, but now has become embraced by millions and millions of people, including in red states, where expanding Medicaid has passed at the ballot in states like Idaho, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Missouri. These are not Democratic enclaves and passed by considerable margins. So lifting up who is obstructing and what is the cost of obstruction will be a key strategy, broadly speaking.
Yeah, even in red states, the minimum wage rise is winning by a huge margin.
Right.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Larry Kleinman. He co-founded Pecon, Oregon's Farm Worker Union and Immigrant Rights Organization. He was a longtime secretary treasurer. He remains an advisor to Pecon. And he also works with the Fair Immigration Reform Movement. It's called FIRM. It's the national lobby for immigrant rights. Many, many groups and members. Some of like 60, Larry, you told me. It's the group that charts their national immigration policy. We've been discussing the Biden administration and its challenges, the threat from the right if COVID is not stopped and the economy revived. We've also begun discussing that, in fact, these measures to deal with COVID and then revive the economy, there's possibilities by forcing the Senate. Let's talk about that more. So, Larry, you pointed out they have to get a large COVID relief stimulus package. That seems to me the bottom line for the Biden administration. It would create jobs. It would probably revive the economy. And then if the vaccines work, the economy could really heat up. It would be a consumer economy, as you pointed out, but that would be only for a short time. It will not last forever on a finite planet. Let's talk a little bit more about getting some of those Republican senators on board and supporting a big relief package and forcing McConnell to bring it to the Senate floor for a vote. How do you see doing that?
Well, I think it seems at this moment, we're talking here in towards the middle of December, that as part of the budget process, the Congress will pass a smaller relief package that will extend unemployment, probably extend the eviction moratorium, some money for states and localities, probably an extension of the aid to businesses. Given my read of the media reports about it, it's not likely to do enough to carry the country through to the point when the critical mass of vaccination delivery, which I think is next summer, something like that, when that actually thaws the economy enough that it can get going on its own. All that to say that another package is going to be needed, whether it's right away in January, February, or whether it's more like March. And the lived experience of desperation by tens of millions of people and thousands of communities, the brinksmanship of waiting to the last minute. Right now, today, as we speak, 12 million people will lose their unemployment the day after Christmas. There's something like another 12 million people who are more than $5,000 behind on their rent and utilities, a total indebtedness of $70 billion. These are not small things, and they will affect, I think, the psychology of the politics and of the economy. So the idea of another small short-term extension will be welcomed, but will not fundamentally alter the political context, I don't think. It's true, McConnell can resist, and he probably will. You know, he always has his eye on the power politics, the power mapping, and where is his leverage and where is his weakness. His weakness, I would think, that he would think, is the Senate seats in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and North Carolina that are going to be up for election in 2022. And with whoever is in control having the thinnest margin, he's going to be gaming out in his mind how that's going to work. I think if the pressure is correctly focused on exactly who is being hurt by his obstruction, I think that enough force can be built to that he relent. And the longer he holds out, he and his, the more it's going to cost them, I think, in the end. Now, I just want to say one other thing about it. If we are fortunate enough through great organizing to win the two Senate seats in Georgia that will be decided on in the January 5th runoff, we then have a better situation, no question, a 50-50 Senate. But we also include in that 50 that are so-called, that are united with the progressive forces, people like Joe Manchin and John Tester, who are not progressives in any measure at all. And in a 50-50 Senate, everybody is a majority of one. They can block whatever is going to happen with their own vote alone. So I think we have to be mindful, passing the Green New Deal through a 50-50 Senate where two of those 50 are John Tester and Joe Manchin is a near impossibility. The same thing is true of eliminating the filibuster, because Joe Manchin has already declared he's unalterably opposed to eliminating the filibuster. So that's kind of the end of that idea as far as clearing away obstructions. I wouldn't even put it out of the realm of possibility that if there's a 50-50 Senate, the Republicans will go to Manchin and say, just like your governor in West Virginia, Justice, who changed party affiliation in office from Democrat to Republican, and then won re-election as a Republican, why don't you come over to join us? You're more in tune with us than with the Democrats anyway, and we'll offer you X, Y, or Z, whatever, at party advantages or positions, committees, et cetera. I'm not sure he'll go for it, but it just shows how precarious the situation will be, whether McConnell's in charge or whether the Democrats have 50 votes plus a tie-breaking vote of Vice President Kamala Harris.
This is KB Radio. Bill Resnick here from the Old Mole, talking to Larry Kleinman. He co-founded the Corn Oregon Farm Worker Union and Immigrants' Rights Organization. We've been discussing the Biden administration, its challenges, the threat from the right if COVID is not stopped and the economy revived. We've also been talking about the necessity for Biden to stop COVID and then revive the economy and how that could be done. What's central to it, of course, is a very, very large stimulus and COVID relief, stimulus infrastructure building, maybe Green New Deal, not using that term that's been demonized, a huge project that would revive the economy and be able to stop the right, perhaps. Larry, give us a sense of how the immigrant rights movement could maneuver in the Biden administration. There are a lot of things he won't do. There are some things that he would do that might set up structures that would be very important that could be built on.
So there's three big areas, and I'll go through them really quickly, and we can get into them more next week. Three big areas. One is enforcement. The second one is the border. The third one, and by the way, by enforcement, I mean interior enforcement, the border. And the third one is affirmative status. On enforcement, Biden has promised to declare and institute a moratorium on removals starting in his first day in office. Not entirely clear how long it will last. We can talk about that more next week. But that's a key demand of the immigrant rights movement. And it's based on the idea that the Trump administration has made such a mess, as well as incredible suffering, inefficiency, a violation of rights, that we just need to stop and take account of what's happening before we continue in any direction. On the border, it's unclear to me what they're actually going to do. They're going to stop building the wall, but they're going to, I think, reinstitute the guarantees of law for asylum applicants. But the big question on the border is going to be, what will the Biden administration do if there is a renewed surge of folks coming from climate catastrophe and civil breakdown and economic breakdown, especially in Central America? On the question of affirmative status, restoration of DACA is top of the list, as well as renewal of temporary protected status, or TPS as it's called. But there's also pressure for and call for there to be broader programs of status. Those run into some key litigation questions, and this could be either administrative or legislative. Legislative having the kinds of obstacles that we talked about earlier about an obstructionist Senate, and backed up by or pressured by a highly active and vocal Donald Trump, calling attention to anything that the administration does that relaxes or changes something his administration instituted. And it's worth noting, for the general view of all this, worth noting that the think tanks that work on immigration from a progressive perspective have documented more than 400 changes that the Trump administration made, large and small, in practice, regulation, appropriations, personnel, to thoroughly trash the legal immigration process as well as mangle the enforcement and other processes. So there's a huge amount to do, and the meta challenge of the Biden administration is going to be which of those to work on in what time frame, while they're also attempting, as we said earlier when we were talking about the economy, to actually make it better, not simply put back the inadequate provisions that were there when Trump came into office.
Larry, that's a good start on talking about immigration in the next administration. Next week, we'll ask you about measures that would unite families, improve conditions in Mexico a whole lot for people who are trying to immigrate in. And in the long run, maybe we can even think about pushing Honduras and El Salvador and some of the other countries in Latin and South America and Mexico to make conditions a whole lot better for their millions and millions of displaced peasants and workers. There's lots of wealth developing down there. It's going to a very small percent of the population. The U.S. could actually make forced changes in that in the long run. And also the U.S. could change its drug policy, I suspect, which would cripple the narco-terrorists in those countries who are so destabilizing in life. And then there's, of course, the Armed Workforce Modernization Act, which you've worked on for a long time and has a chance of passage. Larry, thanks so much for talking to us today, and we'll continue on next week talking about immigration policy.
It's been great, Bill. Thanks, and I look forward to next week.